In January 2026, the U.S. federal government introduced the most recent edition of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. Although the guidelines represent progress in some areas, other recommendations may have unclear or negative effects on health. I'm Stephen Morrissey, managing editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and I'm talking with Deirdre Tobias, an associate professor in the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Tobias has co-authored a perspective article about the new dietary guidelines and population health. Dr. Tobias, how are the Dietary Guidelines for Americans used in federal programs, and what influence do they have on the public, including on individual food choices?
The dietary guidelines impact what we eat on a regular basis in a number of ways. There are specific programs that are federally funded, such as WIC, Women, Infants, and Children, as well as components of SNAP, that's the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And the programs that rely on federal funding, like school meals and other programs that provide food, do have to comply to the dietary guidelines that are in place. There are many sort of less obvious ways that the dietary guidelines have influence as well. And this can be through sort of as a springboard for a number of policies around either our food supply or availability or marketing that can point to the guidelines and what their content or specific recommendations are as evidence of what the policy should be. There are less obvious ways of also influencing sort of medical professional advice and dietitian advice that individuals might get in a clinical setting. And then we might also in the real world just interact with some of the sort of media campaigns, infographics, or other resources that the HHS and USDA put out after the guidelines are released to promote its guidance on at a more general population level.
So what process does the federal government typically use for updating these guidelines?
The updating is congressionally mandated to occur every 5 years. So both the Departments of Agriculture and HHS are responsible for sort of co-coordinating and co-releasing the dietary guidelines for Americans. This past five-year cycle, I was a member of a scientific committee that is assembled for each of this five-year cycle to review the scientific evidence and put forth our summary of that evidence in a report. So the report that the 20 or so scientists who are tasked with this is meant to be delivered to the federal colleagues. So our report is not the final guidelines, nor is it sort of meant to be readable to the public audience, but it is available. That report summarizes the evidence, literature, gives what we recommend any changes or modifications should be over to the federal colleagues. The departments themselves will then write those guidelines into what we saw released earlier this year as the official dietary guidelines for Americans.
You say in your article, though, that this year there was a departure from those established procedures. So how were the latest guidelines developed?
Right. So since the 80s, when the guidelines were going through this five-year process, the scientific review has evolved quite substantially. But the last several five-year cycles, this sort of approach of having a nominated and vetted committee meet and deliberate, in our case, it was for 2 years, on a regular basis, updating all of the literature, generating this report. That process has been in place for the last several cycles. And this cycle was the first that the federal departments rejected the report from the scientific committee. Many times there are components of the report that don't get integrated into the final DGA. So it's not sort of the first time there's been any controversy or changes to what the recommendations from the scientists are in the final version. But this is the first time that the report itself has been wholly rejected by the HHS and USDA, who then sort of had conducted their own updated reviews in the background instead to replace our report.
So with all of that, what recommendations haven't changed from past editions, and in what areas is there new guidance?
Our report was handed over at the end of 2024. And so there was over a year of waiting to see what the new dietary guidelines would ultimately include. I was relieved to see that the overall recommendations and food groups were essentially unchanged. So recommendations for food groups, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, protein, dairy, which did include in some of the language fortified plant-based alternatives, and healthy fats, those were retained as sort of the core food groups of the recommendations. But there were some important components that differed this time around. And those included sort of the focus of putting a little bit more in the background the plant-based alternatives or plant-based vegetable and non-animal-based versions, particularly for the protein food group. And there were also sort of even with the recommendation to maintain the saturated fat limit at 10%, which many of us were very relieved to see was still in place. Some of the food recommendations are inconsistent with sort of maintaining the 10% saturated fat intake in the real world or unrealistic to actually achieve given sort of the promotion of animal products and full fat dairy in the newest guidelines.
So how evidence-based are those changes?
Our scientific report, as well as the scientific reports of several past dietary guidelines committees going back decades, have recognized the growing science against saturated fat. Saturated fat is a type of fat we get predominantly from animal source foods. So your full fat dairy and cheeses and meats. And these, instead of polyunsaturated fat or monounsaturated fat, so these are your healthy vegetable oils and other fat containing vegetables and products, and even fatty fish. These saturated fats are the sort of bad fats that we see are consistently related with developing atherosclerosis. So that's stiffening of your arteries and cardiovascular disease in particular. And so the literature on saturated fat has evolved and with that has kept this conclusion very strong, recommending sort of a limit on that intake. So that was one area of science that the recommendations for foods that specifically contained higher amounts of saturated fat was quite inconsistent with the literature. For example, recommending full fat dairy, where you have sort of skim milk and full fat milk, the only difference at the end of the day between those is the saturated fat content, as well as the additional calories you get with the full fat version because of that saturated fat. So that was probably the most glaring, in my opinion, departure from the scientific evidence. Again, not just from our scientific report, but the recommendations and report of several dietary guidelines going back decades.
You say in your article that areas of confusion and contradiction remain. So what challenges will be involved in translating this guidance into practice?
The translation of the dietary guidelines usually does take some time. They're not meant to be sort of a public-facing advice document. They are intended to be a springboard for policymakers to sort of leverage the evidence that's put forth as rationale for having maybe regulations on sodium, for example, or providing more fruits and vegetables in WIC and SNAP programs. So when the recommendations are very clear, those policies have a much easier path forward of being implemented, and it's harder to have pushback or any ambiguity in how the healthy diets that these programs put out there can actually do so. But when there's language that makes it easier for industry to push back because, well, what do you mean by don't put chemicals in your food? Everything's a chemical. Ambiguity like that can make it really difficult for policymakers to point to the science if there isn't a very clear definition or sort of quantitative limits to things that should be sort of reduced in our food supply. And so that it really prevents a lot of progress in that space. So the implementation really from more the policy perspective. From the food industry and the general public, I think there's also just a lot of general confusion, sort of misbranding of things like protein, for example. We want people to eat adequate amounts of protein, and that threshold of what that amount might mean could depend on your activity level, your age, your life stage. But we certainly don't hope this means everyone rushes out and drinks a lot of protein beverages and supplements and bars, which aren't really the actual whole foods that were intended in the overall dietary pattern. So again, in addition to the policy and vague language there, some of it could also just be leveraged for marketing of products and sort of misinformation as well, with potential unintended consequences of how they get misinterpreted.
So how should clinicians help patients make dietary choices that support their health in the context of these new guidelines?
The role of the clinician, I believe, is even more important than it ever has been for conveying what a healthy dietary advice patients may need. the role of diet in chronic diseases and obesity in the US and globally is huge. There's no doubt of the link between what we eat on a regular basis and our health. And if clinicians are well-equipped and educated to provide that information in a very sort of consistent and helpful way, then I think that helps the patient sort of build that level of trust and awareness and hopefully confidence to be able to help make healthier choices. When the clinician isn't even educated properly, then that, of course, can be a real sort of gap, which should be part of healthcare. But I think if clinicians do need a place to go or look to, there are a number of organizations around the US and globally that do have alternative dietary guidelines. The 2020 dietary guidelines are also available in online. Those would represent sort of much more of the scientific basis that was put forth in our report in the past several rounds before us. But also at the end of the day, if you look at the quantitative recommendations for most of the food groups that I had mentioned, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, protein sources, dairy, and fortified alternatives, those have not largely not changed, nor have limits for added sugar, saturated fat, and sodium. So some of the major core tenets of healthy eating have not changed. And having a sense of what that means at the individual level, of course, could also be handled with our nutritionists and dietitians who understand these at greater depth as well.
Finally, you described the need for structural changes to the food environment. So what might those changes look like and what would be involved in making them happen?
First and foremost, we need more research to be able to hand over to the food manufacturers and industry what exactly should be either reduced or banned altogether. And I think that ultra-processed food category that we hear a lot about these days clearly has some signal with our health. And eating more of these foods and sugary beverages has, under this new name, ultra-processed foods, been very consistently linked to a number of health outcomes. We need evidence to know what people should be eating instead, or if it is just a subcategory of these foods, what would we want to change about those foods, or should we eliminate them altogether? We have very few sort of success stories of having evidence lead to something being banned or regulated. Like trans fat was one big historic achievement where nutrition science showed quite clearly how that should change in our food supply. But we've also had many targets in nutrition where the progress has been very slow. And added sugars, sodium, refined grains, these are nutrients of public health concern spanning decades. We've known that they're linked to a number of cardiometabolic diseases and obesity, yet they're ubiquitous in our food supply with really very little regulation at the end of the day to help improve what we eat every single day. So I think there's a lot of political will to even just acknowledge what we already have known as established health risk factors in our food supply. Then on top of that, if there are additional culprits in these ultra-processed foods that we're consuming so much of in our calorie supply every day, we need research to really disentangle what those are so that we can make, you know, the overall food supply healthier while also sort of promoting the whole foods and the healthy foods that we've been trying to do for a very long time. There hasn't been a shortage of understanding that fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and all these really whole minimally processed foods are healthy for us. It's really the implementation that's been so difficult and has so many real world barriers to it. So again, thinking about the clinician giving advice, the patient may have all the intent and will in the world to go out and eat healthier for their comorbidities and their weight maintenance. But when you walk and you step outside into our food environment, it just works so hard against all of that. So having the default healthier options be what we're advising patients to consume, but also realistically they're able to have access and affordability to, requires just much broader and bigger systemic changes than simply giving individuals advice.
Thank you, Dr. Tobias.